Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Come up today, Wither the Piltdown Man. We'll dig up some dirt on the 100th anniversary of archaeology's notorious fake find. And a viral video of a giant squid inspires us to revisit the human fascination with slithering sea monsters and the legend of the Kraken. And Guster goes acoustic. We'll speak with a frontman from the pop rock band about keeping things fresh and resisting gimmicks. But we begin with robots making rounds. Last week, the FDA approved the first self-navigating communications robot for use in hospitals. The RP Vita, which stands for Remote Presence Virtual Independent Telemedicine Assistant, was created by iRobot and InTouch. It's not a new tool. It's long been used by residents of developing countries to remotely interface with skilled doctors. But the FDA sanction for the self-guided robot could mark a new era of robotic care in hospitals here in the U.S. Joining us with more on how RPA Vita works is Marcio Marcedo. He's Director of Product Management for iRobot's Remote Presence Business Unit. Marcio, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Oh, thank you very much, Virginia.
So what is the RPA Vita robot designed to do?
It's the first robot of its kind, and it allows doctors to be at the bedside of the patient, providing the right care and the right specialist and the right follow-up. It is the first robot that delivers an autonomous navigation capability, so the doctor has freedom to move within the hospital to go meet all the patients that need to be cared for.
So when you say a remote doctor to visit, so what does it look like? Would there be a video screen with a doctor?
Exactly. The patient sees a video screen with the doctor, and the doctor has the ability to see the patient and access all the medical records and live monitoring that is available normally at the bedside. The typical application is the doctor will be at home or at a central hospital and being able to provide a high level of care or personalized care to the patient that may be hundreds of miles or thousands of miles away.
Remote telepresence robots have been approved for use by the FDA. The RPA Vita is the first self-navigating version to get the official stamp. What's the distinction here?
The distinction is instead of requiring the doctor to drive the robot to each patient's bedside, the doctor can now simply choose the name of the patient or a room number or, for example, the nurse's station, and the robot will autonomously drive from wherever it is to the location the doctor wants to be, and the doctor doesn't need to be driving along the way. And, of course, it's cleared for safety, it will not hit any patients, and it'll plan its route to get there in the fastest amount of time possible.
It sounds like the Google self-driving car being developed, I guess, except it navigates hospital corridors instead of highways.
Very similar technologies, yes. The robot has a map of the hospital, and it can know where it needs to go and how to get there the best possible way.
So how does this improve patient care?
This enables the patient to receive the right care, either from a specialist that may not be available locally, or their personal doctor may be not available at that point in time, maybe a long drive away, and they can get the personal care from their personal doctor. Studies show that patients want to receive care from their personal doctor, even if it's on a video screen, versus having care from a doctor that's unfamiliar to them.
Mm. How much does one of these machines cost, Marcio?
They do cost on a lease basis. We target anywhere between $4,000 and $6,000 per month. That's the cost to the hospital. And, of course, it's amortized through all the patient visits that occur. It is a technology that, in bringing the right level of care, has a chance to improve care as well as reduce costs over time.
How about hackers? Isn't there a potential for other parties to access the doctor-patient connection?
The solution is compliant with what's called HIPAA, which is the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act of 1996.
So the privacy clause.
It specifies very clearly the encryption that needs to be in place to avoid any intrusion, as well as how the data is handled to maintain the privacy of the patient record.
I'm wondering if we're looking to a different model for medical care. A doctor may be able to be based in one place who could be on staff at multiple hospitals. Is this what you're envisioning?
Yeah, this is certainly the type of environment that is enabled by this technology. Doctors can, for example, conduct surgery one day in various hospitals and the next day do all the follow-up care and recovery without having to drive to each facility. So certainly it extends the reach for the doctor to perform their job in multiple occasions, but not have to be at every site every day to get the care patients need.
Marcio Macedo, Director of Product Management for iRobot's Remote Presence Business Unit. I want to thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, Regina.
For more on the RP Vita robot, including videos of it in action, go to our Facebook page, Word of Mouth Radio. Now, that's where you can also post your thoughts. Would you be comforted by a doctor if you were talking to her through a telepresence robot? You can chime in on Facebook or send us a tweet at Word of Mouth. Nurse or a doctor, but imagine that one of the most difficult things to teach a medical professional is bedside manner. Abby Goodenough is a healthcare reporter for the New York Times, and she recently detailed the story of Martha Cacheron. She's a retired nurse dying of pancreatic cancer who, in the final chapters of her life, offered herself up to nursing students at Holyoke Community College as a case study in terminal illness. Abby, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, Virginia. Thanks for having me.
Well, what a story. Tell us more about Martha Cacheron. How did she become connected to Holyoke Community College's nursing program?
Well, Martha had been a student there herself back in the early 1990s. She went back as a mid-career person. She was 40 when she got her RN degree from Holyoke Community College. She'd been working in a factory before that for some years. And so she went into nursing at midlife, fell in love with it as a career, but couldn't keep doing it once she got sick, when she got diagnosed with pancreatic cancer in 2006.
So what was she offering to the students there?
Well, she was quite sick and she was bedbound right around Thanksgiving, and she had this idea. And she called the college and left this remarkable message, just basically offering herself up as a teaching tool.
Wow.
You know, some people donate their bodies to science after they die. She was effectively donating her body to science before she died, so nursing students, as she had once been, could experience what it was like to tend to the dying and just to care for somebody at the end of their life.
And to have a dialogue about it, which
I imagine
doesn't happen a lot.
Yeah, the main thing she said was, ask me more questions, ask me more questions. That's what she would say when they visited. And it could be about her cancer, could be kind of a science question, or it could be a question about dying and how she felt about it.
Abby, how are nursing students generally taught about dealing with terminally ill patients? Is it a required topic, you know, like anatomy or coronary care?
It is, but it doesn't get nearly the time and attention that it probably should, because, you know, the healthcare profession is whole focus is healing people. And so most of nursing school and medical school is spent learning how to heal people. And, you know, all of us, including the medical profession, don't like to talk about dying. Yes, it's included in the curriculum, and they do learn a bit about palliative care and how to care for the terminally ill. But a lot of people feel like it's not part of the curriculum nearly as much as it should be, given that this all happens to all of us.
Right. I mean, this is something that we hear a lot about the case for palliative care and hospice care, that, you know, people can die with dignity. And I'm wondering what she was able to teach these training nurses during this experience.
Well, one thing that she clearly taught them was how to be more comfortable around a patient who is dying. When these two students first started visiting her, they were really nervous. They hadn't really ever, not in a personal way, been around a patient who was dying, and they didn't know what to say, and they especially didn't know what to say when she looked them in the eye and said, I'm ready to go. I want you to know I feel good about this, and I'm ready to die. And, you know, their first instinct was to say, oh, I'm so sorry. And they came to realize that it was a wonderful thing that she felt ready, and they learned how to be happy and comfortable in that news with her.
I'm wondering, she insisted apparently that students and nurses kept visiting her, kept talking to her as she was in decline and the cancer was spreading. What do you think these exchanges meant for Martha? What did they do for her?
Well, it gave her purpose. For sure. And I think that, you know, Martha had been sick longer than this, but she'd been diagnosed for 6.5 years with cancer. And she was always looking, from what I have learned, for ways to, you know, just sort of get more out of life and contribute more to life. And I think that even as I think as the pain got more excruciating, she saw this in part as a possible distraction and something that would keep her mind off the pain because she felt so good about the teaching experience.
I want to go back to that diagnosis. She was told by a doctor in 2006 that she would probably die within a year or two. Now, I hear various things about this, that oftentimes doctors aren't straight enough with people about the time they have left, maybe inaccurate. I mean, is this common for someone to survive a diagnosis by this much time?
With pancreatic cancer, with the kind she had, I think it is really uncommon. And I do think you're right that a lot of doctors, it's all over the map what doctors decide to tell terminally ill patients, partly because it's true, nobody knows exactly the day you're going to die, and there's so many complicating factors. But in her case, the prognosis proved wrong. Even when she went on hospice, I believe it was seven and a half months before she died, and they told her, you have 6 months at the most, and she outlived that. So she kept on keeping on, I think, as long as she could. And I know that she was keeping on in particular to get as much out of this teaching experience as she could.
It's a wrenching and inspiring and in very many ways beautiful story. I'm wondering about for you. I mean, one thing is the people who are learning about caring for people. You're a reporter known for sort of standing back and taking an objective role. What was this story like for you to write?
It was hard. I have to tell you, from a personal standpoint, part of the reason that I was drawn to the story to begin with was that my own father died of cancer a decade ago. Mm-hmm. Different kind of cancer, but he did go through hospice, and we did, you know, spend his last weeks and days and hours right there with him and learned about death in a very personal way. And that hospice experience had been so interesting to me and to my family. And worthy that I thought that I admired what she was doing and gave it some personal resonance to me.
Well, thank you so much for passing it on.
Thank you.
Abby Goodenough is a healthcare reporter with the New York Times. You can read her article about Martha Cachurin at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Stay with us for the so far uniquely human achievement of ice climbing. A rock star climber comes home to the White Mountains. We'll hear that after a short break.
Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. It has been a century since scientists announced the discovery of the Piltdown Man, and only 60 years since the find was exposed to be a fraud. Here to talk about the centennial of the discovery of Piltdown Man is Robert Goodby, an archaeologist and associate professor at Franklin Pierce University. Great to have you with us, Robert.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
A strange anniversary to be celebrating, but really a fascinating one. Describe the Piltdown Man. What did he look like?
Well, a Piltdown Man consisted of two pieces of bone, one partially fossilized that was the very large, modern-looking human cranium, and the second was an extraordinarily primitive ape-like jaw. Now, the two of them were found in a gravel pit in the village of Piltdown in Sussex, England, sort of rattling around with a lot of loose material, and the claim was made that they went together, that the jaw was that belonged to the cranium, and when you put them together, you had the ultimate missing link. You had something that was, on the one hand, very ape-like, on the other hand, with its big brain, looked like a modern human.
So being a missing link, it was a huge archaeological find, or at least purported to be.
Absolutely. You know, at this time, you know, 1912, when the discovery is made, there is almost nothing in the way of a fossil record for human evolution. Now, science had accepted the idea that humans, like other animals, had evolved, but there was very little evidence to go on. And here you have a fossil that could wrap everything up. Now, there were a couple of problems with it. And one of them was that they didn't actually quite fit together because, as luck would have it, the pivots or hinges on the top of the jaw, the condyles, were broken off. both of them. So the jaw could not be precisely fitted to the skull. And that was a problem for the get-go and raised some skepticism among some of the scientific community.
Well, and there was a reason for that. It didn't go.
It didn't go. Absolutely not. But it took another 40 years to really nail that down.
So what was the Piltdown Man actually, in reality?
Well, the Piltdown Man in reality was an old human. And when I say human, I mean modern human, Homo sapiens, an old human cranium from an adult male with the mandible of a female orangutan.
Okay, so one of these things is not like the other.
Absolutely.
Well, did the revelation of a hoax come quickly? I know you said there were some suspicions, but what was the final indictment or evidence against the hoax?
Well, it did take a while. Now, initially with the discovery, there were quite a few skeptics, including some very prominent people like Sir Arthur Keith, who would go on to become one of the great defenders of Piltdown. But it was really after that a matter of accretion. And one of the nice things about science is that you're supposed to be able to replicate your findings. And after Piltdown had been discovered, there were decades of work done at the site to try and find additional remains led by Arthur Smith Woodward, who was one of the leading scientists supporting Piltdown. And none of them were forthcoming.
Who were the perpetrators here? Was that ever truly identified?
Well, there's been a lot of debate, a lot written about it. I don't think it's that big a controversy, and I don't think it's the most important part of the story. The most obvious perpetrator is the discoverer, a gentleman named Charles Dawson, who was a very respected amateur geologist and paleontologist. Yet after his career was over, turns out to have been the author of numerous fakes and frauds, mm-hmm. and there were a lot of problems with many of his discoveries. A second possible culprit is Martin Hinton. And Hinton was Woodward's assistant at the British Museum and hated his boss. Mm. After his death, actually in the 1970s, an old chest was found in the attic of the museum with Hinton's initials on it. And inside were a bunch of bones that had been stained and altered very much like the Piltdown fossil.
Oh, and I see a mystery novel coming out of this.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So there are a couple of obvious culprits, and there are some lesser known people, including Sir Arthur Conan Doyle has been mentioned as possibly involved in this. But I think those are your two leading culprits right there.
I'm speaking with the archaeologist and also associate professor at Franklin Pierce University, Robert Goodby, about the Piltdown Man's legacy. This was discovered in 1912, 100 years ago, in a pile of gravel. I think they were digging for a new supermarket or suburb, mm-hmm. if I'm remembering correctly. It was actually a great scientific hoax. And that's the question, Robert. You know, this was at a time in the early 20th century when Charles Darwin's theories were still fairly new, were being tested, embraced by men of science, as they say. Did this set back the cause or the theory of evolution for those who were studying it and dubious of it in the first place?
I don't really think it had that effect. It certainly set back the study of human evolution and led us down a blind alley for a number of decades. And that, I think, was where the real damage occurred. The fact that this fraud was perpetrated, I think, doesn't affect in any way the validity of the idea of evolution. So it was also, and you have to sort of put it in the context of the time, there was almost nothing to compare it to. There was no fossil record for human evolution mm-hmm. at this point.
Especially not in Northern Europe.
There was almost nothing. There had actually been in 1856 a skull discovered in the Neander Valley in Germany, mm-hmm. which gives rise to the name Neanderthals. But even that skull was examined by German scientists, and they went with what they knew. They looked at its odd shape and its sloping forehead and its very primitive nature and concluded it was probably a Frenchman and actually said that this was one of the soldiers from the Napoleonic Wars who had died in Germany and wasn't recognized as an important hominid ancestor for decades.
Well, when you hear about or read about those bad guesses, are you so convinced that we're doing it right now? I mean, they were convinced at one point, weren't they?
No, they were. And that's the way science works, and that's, I think, the great triumph in this story, is that this fraud did not stand. They were unable to find more of these in England, and meanwhile, Africa, as Darwin had predicted, Africa began producing all sorts of fossils that seemed to reflect early human evolution. And eventually, by the early 1950s, they said, let's take another closer look at this Piltdown thing. Then when they did, oh my goodness, you put it under magnification, you can actually see the file marks on the teeth. because the teeth had to be filed to make it all fit together. You can see where the chemicals have stained the jaw to make it look older. And so that was discarded. And we moved on to other ideas. And for the most part, those have stood the test of time.
Well, so it wouldn't be so easy to pull off such a hoax today.
I think it would be much more difficult because there is that context to compare things to.
When you teach the Piltdown Man today, are you looking at it as history? Or are you teaching it to your students as history or maybe a cautionary tale for students of archaeology?
I think both of those, and also an example of how science should work and should not work. And the history is interesting because the late Stephen Jay Gould once said that the important thing about science is that it's done by human beings and not by robots. And that's true. But being humans, we bring biases, assumptions, our own folly into the study of this. And at the time, there were two ideas that were really important in the study of human evolution. One was the so-called big brain theory. In comparing human beings to apes, the most obvious thing that separated us was our social intelligence, our language, our tool use, our large brain. And so scientists concluded that the first change on the route to becoming human was the development of a large brain. And so the search was on for a big-brained ape-like ancestor. Well, it turns out that's completely wrong. The first change was beginning to walk upright, and the big brain develops much more slowly over time. The second thing, and again going back to Darwin, was the idea of African origins. Darwin accurately predicted that's where we came from, but early evolutionary thought was very, well, white supremacist. And the idea that humans came from Africa was hard to swallow, and that made Piltdown all the more seductive.
Robert Goodby, I want to sign up for your class. Fascinating talking with you. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Robert Goodby, Associate Professor at Franklin Pierce University and an archaeologist. We do have a link to a picture of Piltdown Man at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Conditions in New Hampshire's White Mountains are notoriously more harsh than ranges of similar altitude. Those conditions make the Whites a perfect training ground for world-class mountaineers. NHBR's Sam Evans-Brown spent the day with one of them.
It's a windy but warm winter day. Fred Wilkinson hopes the thaw will make for what he calls sticky ice over at Cathedral Ledge, meaning easily pierced by the pointy end of an ice axe.
Cool. We'll just stop here and put on crampons and helmet. And this is kind of like the Bunny Hill. On a 10-degree day, the ice is much more brittle, and you have to work a lot harder.
Wilkinson is a lot of things. A wiry, good-natured ice and rock climbing guide based in North Conway who fills out the off-seasons with writing for climbing magazines and has written a book about an alpine expedition gone wrong. And increasingly, at age 33, he's a little bit of a legend. We bump into another group of crampon-clad, pick-wielding outdoors folk.
You know any of these cats?
Yeah, this is Joan. Hey, Joan! How are you?
Guys, what's nice happening? This is Freddie Wilkinson. Have you guys heard about him? He's just a local guy. He lives in a cabin.
Yeah.
Joan Veyer is another local guide, taking a group of young, fresh-faced mountain shop employees out for an introduction to ice climbing clinic. If you hang out with Wilkinson at Cathedral Ledge long enough, you start to feel a little starstruck. We meet another local ice climber along the way, Dave Gianpietro. It's the first time he's met Wilkinson, but it's not the first time he's heard of him.
Everyone knows who Freddie is, sure.
He will do climbs. He is such a good climber. He will do climbs, lead them where people won't even follow him up.
He's the Tom Brady of ice?
That's a gross exaggeration, because I'm a Pats fan.
So he says, but his laurels say otherwise. Last year, Wilkinson and two expedition mates climbed the second tallest previously unscaled peak in the world, a 24,000-foot peak in a recently demilitarized border zone between China, India, and Pakistan called Sasser Kongri 2. They did it without supplemental oxygen, in a super light and fast style that appeals to the traditional French alpinists who dictate the canon of the sport.
Alpine climbers will go to extraordinary lengths to shave gear, and so to save an extra 2 pounds and also conserve body heat, it's cheaper for us just to snuggle up with your partner at night than it is to carry separate bags.
The climb won them a prestigious award from two French mountain magazines, the Piolet d'Or, That means golden ice axe for the aspiring Francophile mountaineers out there. Mounting and taking part in wild expeditions to the most remote and rugged corners of the world is Wilkinson's other job. A sponsor pays him a stipend for being an ambassador for the sport and supports those trips, having him take photos and do slideshows around the country.
My life is crazy. I go on a couple of big expeditions every year, and I just came back from Antarctica on an expedition that was supported by National Geographic.
Wilkinson says there's plenty of good ice climbers and mountaineers in New Hampshire, but what sets him apart is his drive to get out to the greater ranges, the Himalayas, the Andes, and some of the Alaskan ranges. His resume is dotted with first ascents of routes all over the world. Wilkinson says a lot of his training happens right here in New Hampshire, where the irregular ice flowing over granite crags forces mountaineers to learn stuff they'll need to get up something 20,000 feet tall. It's meant a whole slew of world-class climbers have cut their teeth in the whites. Mark Sinnott, Brad Washburn, Kevin Mahoney, these are big names in the climbing world. For Wilkinson, who's at the top of that world right now, there are dozens of expeditions left. But when he's all done, he says New Hampshire's where he'll wind up.
There are so many talented climbers, and my friends here aren't that impressed by anything I do on expeditions. I come home and they say, "Great, that sounds like a cool trip. We're going out to Evans Notch tomorrow. You want to come?"
And when he does, after months of sitting on planes and eating the wrong foods, Wilkinson says those buddies, quietly living in the shadow of Mount Washington, put him to shame. For Word of Mouth, I'm Sam Evans Brown.
To see a gallery of photos from Wilkinson's award-winning ascent in the Himalayas or a video of him ice climbing in North Conway, take an easy trek on over to wordofmouthradio.org. Last week, a team of scientists and filmmakers from Japan's National Museum and the Discovery Channel released the first ever video footage of a giant squid. The video captures the squid swimming at a depth of 2,100 feet in waters far off the coast of Japan. The video instantly went viral and was heralded as a breakthrough for science and mythology. Stories of giant slithering beasts lurking in the deep have been terrifying sailors for centuries, perhaps even inspired by an early sighting of a giant squid. The legendary elusiveness of these monsters may explain why every development or discovery in giant squid science makes big news. Wendy Williams follows every new tick. She's author of Kraken, the curious, exciting, and slightly disturbing science of squid. We spoke with her when the book first came out about what inspired her enthusiastic pursuit of the squid.
Well, first of all, you have to understand I come from the Midwest, so the whole thing about the ocean is a big surprise to me. And I found the concept of a very large animal in there, the Kraken, to be a little disturbing, hence the title. Mm-hmm. You know, what are these large, unpredictable things doing in the ocean? But I was also a science writer fellow, and I found it absolutely fascinating that pretty much the same neuron that your brain and my brain uses in order to function is the same neuron of the squid. And yet, we separated from them evolutionarily well over 700 million years ago.
The book itself is divided into three sections. The first is kind of diving off into the squid tale. I just love this story, this 19th century sighting of a giant squid off of Newfoundland. Tell us that story.
Well, it's a horrific tale, isn't it? It's a lot of fun to read as long as you're not in the boat with the guys. In the late part of the 19th century, this fisherman and his assistant went out in a little skiff over Conception Bay. And they were out looking for herring, and over across the water, they saw this big thing lying on the surface of the water, and they thought, oh, look, a sail. We can take that home and use it. So they went over to get it, and it turned out to have two huge dinner plate eyes, which looked at them, and then these two massive tentacles shot out at them like arrows, and they grasped the boat. And the fellows were in a lot of trouble. Luckily, they happened to have a tomahawk on board, because everyone in a skiff has a tomahawk, and they chopped the tentacles off the animal, and the animal ran away. Well, sped away. I guess they don't actually run in the water. And the fellas brought back the tentacles themselves and handed them over to the local minister, whose name was Moses Harvey. He was an amateur naturalist. So he actually recorded these tentacles. He wrapped them in all kinds of exciting poses and sent the illustration and a scientific report off to a London natural history journal. And at that point, the whole controversy over whether these animals were mythological or actually real ended, and there was actual proof.
Well, I thought that was so interesting, that sort of idea that, oh, you must be making this story up. It's too fantastic to be conceived. But that's one of the things we learn, Wendy, in your book. Squid are very difficult to truly study. Why? Why are they so difficult to keep in captivity?
Well, the interesting thing about squid, there's a big difference between octopus and squid. Octopuses are called the intellectuals of the cephalopod world. You know, they're likely to sit under an octopus garden and contemplate their navel for a long period of time. They don't actually have a navel, but metaphorically. Squid, on the other hand, are sometimes called the wolves of the ocean, and they run around in packs and attack things. They're very reactive. And what that means for science is that if you capture squid, you can't really keep them in captivity for very long.
Are squid intelligent? I mean, as the wolves?
You know, there's an awful lot of people who think they are. I was very, very surprised. I thought I'd get a lot of skepticism. But instead, of all the scientists that I talked to while I worked on this book, only one was skeptical about the intelligence of these animals. My favorite comment was from Smithsonian's Clyde Roper, who's a fabled giant squid hunter, and he said, when you look into their eyes, you know there's something there. So.
Okay, Wendy, well, we do know that there is a great deal of understanding about the human brain that is actually coming from the study of squid. Tell us why. Why is that an important correlation?
Well, it turns out that a very small kind of squid that we have here in the waters off Cape Cod, a market squid that'll actually fit in your hand, has what has become known as a giant axon. There's a giant squid that has a regular axon, but there's a small squid that has a giant axon. And this giant axon, when it was discovered, is large enough that you can actually see it with your eye. Sometimes it's as large as a pencil lead, but sometimes it's not quite that large. But it's you can see it, you can handle it, and that meant that science could work with it long before all of the modern technology was developed. So that's how we first learned how the neurons in our own brains functioned, by studying these large axons of the small squid.
Well, one notorious squid that really does capture the human imagination is this giant squid, rarely seen in the wild, never captured alive. Now, where are we with that whole giant squid mystery?
Oh, we're learning a little bit more, but to tell you the truth, we really know nothing about this animal. That's what people love about it. People are intrigued that an animal that large can live in the ocean and still be so mysterious. When I started to think about writing this book, I thought, I'll check it out and see whether people are interested. So I went around to all the local bookstores on the Cape and I asked people about it. Would you be interested in a book about squid and a book about giant squid? And people said, oh, yes, I really would be. And I said, why? And they said, because they love the idea that there's still mystery on this earth. There's still parts of this earth that we really don't understand, and that we're foreigners when we go down there and try to learn about them.
Wendy Williams is author of Kraken, the curious, exciting, and slightly disturbing science of squid. You'll find more on her book and see that video of the giant squid captured off the coast of Japan. It's on our Facebook page, Word of Mouth Radio. We've also posted a link to more on the Discovery Channel special about chasing and filming the Kraken in its natural habitat. That's at wordofmouthradio.org. And and stay with us for Guster, the band so many people loved in college is still playing, still growing, and is determined not to put on spandex and become a nostalgia act. A conversation with Guster frontman Ryan Miller when Word of Mouth continues after a short break. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott, and you're listening to Do You Love Me off Live Acoustic. It's a new album from the band Guster that came out earlier this week. Guster's stripped-down acoustic tour is stopping at the Music Hall in Portsmouth tonight. The show is already sold out, which is kind of typical for the band that sprang out of Boston in the early 1990s and hit the pop charts with the 1999 song Fa Fa. Ryan Miller is guitarist, lead singer, and primary songwriter for Guster, and he's joining us now from, what, somewhere on the road, right, Ryan?
Somewhere.
Really glad to have you.
I don't know where I am, but I was just sitting in an Eames chair at a community college, so I was very happy about that.
That's pretty good.
I know. I felt good. I was like, let's do it. By the way, that's the most I've listened to our new acoustic live record was just then when it was playing.
Wow. So you guys toss these things off and then what? You just move on?
No, I mean, this whole thing happened so quickly. You know, we did this tour last spring in April of 2012. We had been talking about doing an acoustic tour forever, and then we got these string arrangements, and we just kind of documented it just to do it. And then, I don't know, some email went around in, like, October or November, like, we're going to do an acoustic album. We need to name it in a day, and you need to, and we've already mixed it in. So I didn't even, that's why the name is so benign, Acoustic Live. Like, that's the worst name ever. How did that happen?
And we were kind of wondering how you came up with that.
Just terrible. The cover of that thing, I drew something on an iPad, and I sent it, and, like, 10 minutes later, it was the cover. It was so thrown together, and I never listened to it because I knew I couldn't change it. So I just listened to it. It sounded pretty good.
Yeah, it does sound pretty good. And there is a kitty cat, by the way, on the cover. I should let our listeners know.
I'm not really a great artist. I probably shouldn't be doing cover art for albums.
Well, since we now know that you guys plan things so carefully, I'm curious about the rules for the acoustic tour. So what's the rule? You can plug in an amp, no pedals?
Yeah, well, we sort of, I mean, the main thing is that we're sitting down and that people are in seated venues, which we've never done before. I mean, we've always kind of fought against playing seated venues, even when we played, you know, the Music Hall in Portsmouth, we always, like, encourage people to stand up right away. The conceit that we would sit and people would sit is sort of changed the philosophy and the context of everything. It feels like we kind of get away with some slower songs, some songs deeper in our catalog. And also, like, we brought out a real piano, and we bring out these, you know, a cellist and a violinist. The goal at this point is to keep trying to challenge ourselves to do some interesting things. What can we do that's going to really shake things up, that's going to make things more interesting for us, more interesting for our fans? How can we interface with the music in a way that's not like, hey, here's this band, and they're going to play Demons for the 7,000th time, mm-hmm. you know?
Well, let's hear one of those old songs that you dug up for the live album. This is a little bit from Rocket Ship. Now, this is originally off of the 1998 album Goldfly.
Warning sign for them. Read my apology. Their hope of disbelief. But no. Coming.
That's the song Rocket Ship, performed by Guster from their new acoustic live record. Since we're auditioning this for you today, Ryan, what do you think?
That's weird. I'm kind of mad because I kind of wanted to get through life never having heard it. They're not really allowing me to do that.
Well, should I give you like a spoiler alert? You can just block your ears when we're going to play bits of your music.
You're going to be like, okay, you have 25 seconds. And I'll put my fingers. not listening to you. Not listening.
Well, one of the things this band, your band, is known for that, you know, so many people love about you, great pop hooks and lots of playing around with rhythm track. I want to know how to pronounce his name first. Your percussionist, Brian Rosenworcel.
Wow. Look at you.
Well, you know, I do. This is an NPR interview. You are in an Eames chair.
We are next level there. I'm impressed.
Well, he's known for playing things almost exclusively with his hands. I'm wondering if he's using a drum set through this tour, or is he just going acoustic with his hands?
Yeah, no, he's doing more of the drum kit thing. There's sort of been all these different versions of our band, and I think these big distinct chapters, and I think the first like iteration of Guster was defined by Brian playing exclusively percussion parts. And then after we made our album Lost and Gone Forever in 1999, he was feeling really stifled creatively. You know, I think he felt like he was stuck playing these certain kind of rhythms and this certain kind of way. Eventually, you know, just as turning into adults and starting to understand music more, like, well, let's not be a gimmicky band. I mean, there was a moment, you know, that I had reading the liner notes of Lost and Gone Forever, that last album we did with percussion exclusively, and it's like all the sounds were made using hand drums, no sticks. It was like, who cares? You know what I mean? Like, I remember seeing that too, like on a Rage Against the Machine, like Tom Morello, those aren't keyboard sounds, those are made using guitar. But like, I don't care about that stuff when I'm listening to music. I don't care if it's fake or if it's real, or if it was recorded with a $1 million studio or like a 4-track at home, as long as it's working for the song.
Okay, well, plug your ears because we're going to hear another tune.
Oh, God, how long? I'll put
well,
it on my timer.
Let's see. I don't know, maybe 20 seconds.
Is this the first time you've done an interview where you had to warn the guy that you're about to play his music and to plug his ears?
Well, usually they're kind of behind the music that they're putting out there. I don't know.
No. And I don't even think it's bad. I've been enjoying it. You know what? I'm going to unplug my ears for the next 20 seconds.
All right. How about this is Satellite, the hit single from your 2006 release, okay. Ganging Up on the Sun. Here's a live acoustic recording from the new album by Guster. Song Satellite, and it's from the new acoustic live album from Guster. We're speaking with Ryan Miller of Guster. He's the guitarist, lead singer, and primary songwriter for the band. Ryan, you know, one of the things that struck me when I was listening to your songs anew with this album was thinking that, you know, they're sunny and optimistic, but deceptively so. You know, like, you're young, 21, everything's under control, and all that gets blown to bits.
Yeah.
What is that? Is that something in your personality?
For me, it was a lot of it came from just being a really big Smiths fan and a really big Morrissey fan, because I loved that about the Smiths, that they wrote these massively poppy, crazy upbeat songs that was like, girlfriend in a coma, I know. For me, it always felt like we could get away singing these super sunny songs if there was some weight that was underneath them that would kind of keep them from floating away. Like that song, Do You Love Me? Like, it was the song, to me at least, is not, hey, do you love me? This is great. But it's about the dissolution of this relationship that kind of like just developed into this stagnant thing after 5 years. And the question isn't so much, we're falling in love and do you love me for the first time? It's more like, hey, we've been in this for 5 or 10 years and do you even love me anymore?
Well, that's a question that I think a lot of couples come to after 5 years. Now you've been together as a band, what, since the early 90s. Do you sometimes look at them and say, okay, do you still love me? Are we still doing this?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, every record since probably Lost and Gone Forever, we'd always had to discover what it is we're trying to say. I mean, especially in the last 5 years, I mean, we all have kids. Between Brian, Adam, and I, we have 7 kids. We're not a cool new band. You know, I lived in Brooklyn for 12 years, and so I was constantly exposed to cool new bands and awesome new sounds and really exciting stuff that's happening out there, and always constantly wondering how we fit into it and if we even did. And right now we're right at the beginning process of where we really feel like, okay, maybe we do have something to say for a 6th record, you know, or I don't even know what record it is, 6 or 7. We're not in a position where we feel like it's just like, okay, we made a record, let's make another one. It's like we made a record and that might be our last one, unless we can find something really special to say, because we have a legacy to protect in this weird way.
Ryan.
Yeah.
We care.
No, I wasn't. I hope I wasn't asking that.
No, I think, but it is interesting because there is a point where a band that was big, like a lot of people that I know, loved you in college.
Yeah, dude, I mean, we could talk about this for 2 hours and it's probably boring for everybody, but it's the thing. I mean, it's my constant battle of like, do we have something new to contribute? Because you see other bands that maybe go on a little bit further than they should. And it's like, okay, as soon as it starts slipping into pure nostalgia is when I want to stop. Thankfully, you know, like Easy Wonderful, our last album, felt like, okay, when we play those songs live, the energy doesn't dip. You know, there's not like people like, oh man, it's these songs. We don't want to hear these. But again, we have to earn that every record. It's not just a foregone conclusion that that's going to be the case.
Well, Ryan Miller, guitarist, vocalist, lead songwriter for the band Guster, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for your kind words, and thank you for exposing me to the live album we just released for the first time.
Now you can sit in your Eames chair and order, like a pink squirrel or something, like
yeah,
a
exactly.
Grasshopper. Guster's playing a sold-out show at the Music Hall tonight. Their new album is Guster Live Acoustic. Is it Live Acoustic or Acoustic Live?
I don't know. What a terrible name. It's just awful.
We're going out listening to the song 2 Points for Honesty, originally released on its seminal 1999 album, Lost and Gone Forever. You can find details on Guster's show at wordofmouthradio.org. Thank you so much for joining us today for a few stories that aroused our curiosity. If you liked what you heard, drop us a line. Or if you're the sharing kind, you can post links to our content on your Facebook page or on Twitter, or email them along to friends. All it takes is the click of an icon over at wordofmouthradio.org. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us again for more Word of Mouth next week from New Hampshire Public Radio.
All right.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Zach Nugent,
Jonathan Lynch,
and senior producer Rebecca Lavoie, with plenty of help from our interns,
Ali Kosmikas
and Bill Barry.
Sarah Plord is our digital producer.
And Dan Colgan runs our board.
Actually, that sounds pretty good.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals,
and not those of NHPR, its board of trustees,
or its underwriters.
To subscribe to our podcasts and listen to our past shows,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join us on Facebook and Tumblr at Word of Mouth Radio.
And check out a playlist of music from the program on Spotify.
Word of Mouth
is a production of New Hampshire
Public
Radio.
That's fancy, right?